compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. I always try to think of some new way to greet you each morning, but it's always the same thing, right? Welcome. It's good to have you here. The number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Lines are open right now, so you can get in right now if you want to. Why don't we just go straight to the top of the most important stories of the day? I'll start with this one. Kraft has come out with a mac and cheese flavored ice cream. How do you feel about that, Cyrus?
Ugh.
That was my reaction. Ooh.
Yeah, some things don't need to be ice cream.
Well, check it out. A limited edition macaroni and cheese flavored ice cream will hit freezers nationwide this week. Van Leeuwen and Kraft Heinz announced Tuesday the cheesy frozen tweet. This is how it's being written up in the New York Post. It doesn't sound like much of a treat to me. It sounds like a punishment. I'm sorry, Mr. Simcoe. For your punishment, you're going to have to eat frozen macaroni and cheese flavored ice cream.
That sounds about right.
That'll teach you.
Yeah, I'll never make that mistake again.
No, because you don't.
I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
stop.
Please.
Please make it stop.
Is there something more lenient you can sentence me to?
Yeah, like solitary confinement.
$12 a pint.
Whoa.
Yeah.
It's mac and cheese. That's the beauty of mac and cheese is that it's inexpensive.
You can get a box of mac and cheese for what, 89 cents?
Are they going to do top ramen flavors next?
They haven't said that.
It's coming.
I don't know. Don't give them any bad ideas. So $12 a pint. It's going to mark National Macaroni and Cheese Day. I didn't even know that that existed. It will be available for purchase in Van Leeuwen stores across the country, as well as online. The two companies described the ice cream as a cool, creamy scoop of ice cream that brings that comforting, nostalgic feeling of a warm bowl of Kraft macaroni and cheese.
macaroni and cheese has never sounded more disgusting.
Oh, my. I don't know who that would give comfort to. Emily Violet, a senior associate brand manager for Kraft macaroni and cheese, says, "We know that there's nothing more refreshing on a hot summer day than a bowl of macaroni." No, she didn't say that. On a hot summer day than ice cream. Well, we now know there is something more refreshing, and that would be a bowl of macaroni and cheese flavored ice cream. She said, "That's why we wanted to combine two of the most iconic comfort foods to create an ice cream with the unforgettable flavor of Kraft macaroni and cheese we all grew up with. What about a meatloaf with gravy and mashed potatoes ice cream?"
Oh,
that's comfort food. How about a chicken pot pie flavored ice cream? That's comfort
Please
food.
Please stop. It's too early.
I can't help myself. This is like the Taco Czar story from yesterday. I wish I could camp out on this indefinitely, but people will get sick.
Taco-flavored ice cream?
No. Even I have my limits.
That's right, as you should.
Yeah, so anyway, so that's going to be available, everybody.
Alrighty then.
Yeah, starting this week. And for a limited time. It's something else that's available for a limited time. It's hard to say how much longer it will be available, is a book by Abigail Schreier. It's called Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. Now, I own a copy of this book. Well, actually, I'll come back to that in a second. I own a copy of the book. I've recommended the book a number of times on this program, especially for parents whose, let's say, teenage daughters are experimenting with or thinking about or even moving in the direction of the LGBTQ world. And in particular, this book deals with the transgender element of all that. It's a very good book. It's well documented. It's well reasoned. It is not florid. It's not polemical. It's just a good, calm, very well laid out argument for why we should be extra careful when it comes to our daughters, because at that young age, many of them, adolescents or pre-adolescents, they don't really know what they want. And so an experimentation like that does not define them. Or if they find themselves curious or drawn in that direction, it does not define them. And the world would want them to be defined by those labels if that were the case. So this is why I say that it's maybe temporarily available right now on Amazon. This is an astonishing story of the tail wagging the dog what does Amazon have by way of employees? Something like 800,000 employees or something like that. Well, at least two, and this is what got NBC News' attention, because at least two of the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Amazon employees, they resigned in recent weeks to protest the company's decision to continue to sell this book that they say frames young people who identify as transgender as mentally ill. The resignations, this again according to NBC News, the resignations come after a complaint posted to the company's internal message board in April drew the support of over 467 Amazon corporate employees, according to a copy obtained by the NBC News team. As of last year, the company employed over 1.3 million people worldwide. So we're talking, in terms of my numbers, the numbers of people who work here in the U.S. The complaint by workers points to a decision Amazon shared with Republican senators in March that claims that it had, quote, chosen not to sell books that frame LGBTQ plus identity as a mental illness. The employee-led petition calls for the removal of the book. The book, again, is called Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters by Abigail Schreier. I would pause here and just encourage you parents, today would be a good day to go on Amazon and buy a couple copies of that book. Buy as many as you can get. Give them to your friends if you have peers who are going through this with their kids. Get a copy of this book because you may not be able to get it easily in the not-too-distant future. In fact, when I said a minute ago that I have a copy of this book, I have about 20 copies of this book now. And they're all brand new. They're all still wrapped up. And I have them on hand because it looks as though in the not-too-distant future it will be very difficult to get it. And I want to have it available to resource out to parents and others who might need this book. Thinking ahead. See, always thinking. Be prepared. That's the Boy Scout motto.
So what's the percentage of Amazon workers here? Is this like 0.00001%?
I don't think it's even that big of the total. I haven't done the math, but yeah, I mean, it's infinitesimally small. The number of Amazon workers are angry about
way
this.
More Amazon workers have quit because of the working conditions. This is just crazy, crazy talk.
I think we should give these 467 Amazon corporate employees a bowl of macaroni and cheese flavored ice cream. That might smooth out their nerves. They might feel better after consuming that comfort food. And then maybe they'll change their mind on this, although I doubt it. So Schreier in the book refers to what she calls the trans epidemic of young girls identifying as transgender. The book is currently listed as the first, second, and third bestsellers for hardcover, softcover, and Kindle editions in Amazon's category of LGBTQ plus demographic studies. Schreier denies that her book frames LGBTQ identities as a form of mental illness. Amazon employees pointed to a passage where Schreier writes, quote, many of the adolescent girls suddenly identify as transgender seem to be caught in a craze, a cultural enthusiasm that spreads like a virus. She goes on to define craze as a crowd mental illness. Elsewhere in the book, Schreier likens therapists who affirm the gender of transgender patients with affirming a young person's anorexia. That's an analogy I've been using for many years. I mean, it's not mine. I didn't patent it or anything, but I certainly agree with that as an analogy. She says, we wouldn't think such a therapist was compassionate, referring to a therapist who might play into the delusion of somebody who thinks, a girl, let's say, who thinks that she's fat when she's really wasting away and her life is in danger. Her point is, you wouldn't think that a therapist was compassionate who didn't try to get some help for this child, who in her own mind truly believes that she is overweight or obese when she's really not. The thing to do, obviously, is to get her some help so she can remain healthy. And it's a valid analogy. It's not a perfect analogy, but it's a valid analogy. And the fact that it is such a valid analogy and it helps get the point across is what I think makes them on the other side there so anxious to remove the book from circulation, because they don't know how to respond to that analogy. They don't have a good answer to it. And that's just part of it, of course. One of the employees who resigned over Amazon's decision to continue to sell the book, Celine Zenia, a software engineer who identifies as trans and worked at Amazon for 7 years, said she left in June after learning the company would still carry the title. She was happier with the decision Amazon made several months ago before to stop carrying another book called When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment, which, by the way, is another very good book. Ryan Anderson, I have a copy of that book. I got it when it first came out. And it is, again, very well documented. It is calm. It is not polemical. It is a critique of this worldview. And isn't that what science is supposed to be all about anyway? You know, a healthy form of skepticism and a willingness to do rigorous analysis and rigorous testing to see if a proposition, if a hypothetical is true, and let's find out. Let's apply some science to this and discover. And that's largely what his book is. It is a calm, rational, science-based discussion of this phenomenon. And they're afraid of that. That's why, and this is why Celine Zenia from Amazon, she was so happy when they decided to get rid of that book. In that book, they claim anyway, it frames transgender identity as a form of mental illness. But she says this latest move by Amazon to continue to sell Irreversible Damage went too far. The book literally, she says, has craze in the title. And of course, the term craze is identified and explained by Schreier, where she says that a craze is a cultural enthusiasm that spreads like a virus. So various forms of mania can be classified as mental illnesses, but Beatlemania is not a mental illness. Although maybe some of the parents might have thought so when their teenage daughters went berserk when the Beatles first came out. Beatlemania is a colloquial phrase. It's a way of describing a cultural enthusiasm that is spreading wildly. And that's the point. In other words, it's not saying that a young girl is necessarily mentally ill because her friends or teachers or high school counselors have influenced her to think that maybe she should change her gender. She's just young and gullible and not mature enough to understand. This is how adolescents are, by and large. Doesn't mean that she has a mental illness, but she may be affected unduly by this kind of a craze, this kind of an enthusiasm. I found it extremely hypocritical, Zenia says, for Amazon to say that it would stock this book and not that other one. It looks like Amazon had to remove that particular book for PR reasons, not because they felt morally obligated to. I don't think Amazon feels morally obligated to do anything other than make money, madam. And if you ask me, the reason that Amazon would get rid of that book or anything else that it deems to be no longer worthy of bringing to the buying public, it's because they think there will be a backlash and it will cost them money. May cast your mind back to when the Charlottesville, I don't know what to call that, the riot, the demonstration that led to violence, and then there was a white supremacist who rammed his car into the crowd, killing at least one person and injuring others. I mean, it was a terrible thing, and it was all about the clash between those who wanted to take down the monuments of Civil War figures and those who didn't want them taken down. So rather than resort to the legal system or to a debate on who has the better ideas, instead it became a violent thing. And you may remember that in the aftermath of that, almost immediately, the Dukes of Hazzard, the orange car, what was it, a duster that they drove around in the South, Daisy Duke and the other two guys, suddenly now you couldn't buy that on Walmart or... You were big on that show, weren't you, Cyrus?
I thought you were waiting for me to jump in with the answer.
Well, I just knew that you probably had an affinity for the duster, the orange duster, because that was for the guys. I mean, there were different hooks in that TV series. I never really watched it, I must say. But there were different hooks for different groups of people to keep them watching, yeah. If you follow my meaning.
I do.
Yeah. And then one of those hooks was that Chevy Duster, that orange, what was it, the General Lee or the Cannonball Lee or something?
Yeah,
that
sounds right, the General Lee. Mm-hmm. It's been years.
Yeah.
All right.
But you're going to go back and get out the DVDs and watch them all over again just to test the theory. But you know, Cyrus, you remember this because from one day to the next, it seemed, once the thing in Charlottesville happened and this new narrative exploded onto the media scene, anything that had a Confederate flag on it disappeared from the shelves. And you couldn't buy it. And Amazon, my theory is this, simply. Amazon is not doing that out of the goodness of its heart. It's not doing it because it has a corporate conscience or because it deems something to be immoral or unethical. I really don't think they operate that way. They want to make money. And so if they see that a die-cast car with a Confederate flag on top, and I know it's the Confederate battle flag. It's not the Confederate flag. I understand all that, but we're using shorthand here. That's the reason why they deep sixed all that stuff. That's the reason why these things disappeared, is because they figured we'll lose less money if we don't make these tchotchke items available for the consumer than we would lose if we maintained these items in our system. And then we had all kinds of backlash and opprobrium coming from the people who just will not tolerate this kind of thing. I think it's just a business decision. That's all, personally. And I really do believe that this book is next on the chopping block. I mean, look, we're talking about it on this program. And the article goes on and on. Schreier, the article, the author of the book, she says in a statement, she says, this issue won't go away just because some disgruntled Amazon employees wish it would. And banning the book won't help these girls or anyone else. My book goes out of its way to honor the experiences of transgender adults. It never disparages them and never implies that the trans identity is a mental illness. She testified before Congress against the passage of the Equality Act this year, which would provide non-discrimination federal rights, federal civil rights protections for LGBTQ people. Keep in mind, this is written by a hard left-wing news outlet. So I'm reporting how they're reporting it. Amazon is among the world's largest online booksellers, and its decisions about what to host and not host on its marketplace can have serious consequences for the distribution of a book. This, according to Morgan Weiland, an affiliate scholar at the Stanford Center for Internet and Society, whose work focuses on technology policy and constitutional law. So don't be surprised if in the next day or two or three, or certainly within the next week or so, that book disappears. Because they don't want you to know what's in it. And I say the reason I think they don't want you to know what's in it is because they don't have an answer to what's in it. Or at least they don't have an adequate answer to what's in it. They can't actually refute the logic that's used here. And just to give you an example, if you can change your gender on a whim, if you can decide that you are the other gender, even though they don't buy into the binary, let's just say you're a man and you say that you want to be a woman, and maybe you really believe that you are a woman trapped in a man's body. If you can do that just because that's how you feel, why can't you change your race? Why is Rachel Dolezal in trouble? She was the chapter chairman of the local NAACP office in her area, and she was masquerading as black and changing her hair and dyeing her skin color, from what it appears, and other things, changing the way she spoke to appear as if she was African-American, when in fact she was white as white can be. And she's in the doghouse now.
Did you hear about the guy who, I think he was British, and he identified as a Korean? And so
yeah.
$500,000 in years of surgery.
And terribly sad story.
It's really sad. And then he comes out, and he gets ridiculed by the people that he thought were going to accept him with open arms.
Right. Yep. Yeah, so like the Korean folk saying, you just had some really bad botched plastic surgery, that's all. You're no more Korean now after the surgery, poor fellow. I feel bad for him because he's pretty disfigured. And he's no more Korean now than he was when he started. And everyone knows that. And why can't we apply the same logic to something like this? Of course we can. But there's no adequate response to that, which is why they want to get rid of these books. So buy these books. I encourage you, buy the books. Not because I want you to make the authors rich. That may happen as a result. But the main thing is so that you have access to this information. This is the modern day equivalent of book burning in Nazi Germany, when they just didn't want the people to have access to ideas that went contrary to Hitler and the Nazis. They would gather books and they would build big bonfires and they would burn them. And the people would celebrate. This is the modern equivalent of the Nazi book burnings. It's the same motivation. They don't want you to know the other side of the story. We need to take a break. Let's do that now. We'll come right back. The number to dial to be on the program is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Also, I've got a little reportage for you about Italy's win in the big soccer match that just happened. And you'll never guess how it was being reported in the mainstream press. I'll get to that right after this. Straightening the curves, flattening the hills. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
A big soccer game, big soccer match, you know, the big game in Europe took place, and Italy won. And everybody's super excited, and it's, you know, one of those things where everybody is, I don't know, just they're just excited about it. Sports has a great way of deconnecting us from all the bad things, all the bad news in the world. And I appreciate that. I really do. But even sports is not free from the nonsense that's out there. So The Economist on Twitter, they have a picture of the successful Italy 26-man team that won the UEFA Euro 2020 soccer tournament. And here's their headline. I mean, they can't just be happy for this team because it won. The most striking aspect, they say, of Italy's 26-man squad before it took to the pitch was that alone among the main contenders, it did not include a single player considered as being of color. That's the lens through which they interpreted this sports victory. They can't let it be what it is. They have to turn it into something racist by saying, look, the Italian team doesn't have any people of color, players of color. Well, okay. And then I was really pleased to see that somebody named El Malvado Rick, he tweeted a comment to them saying, all right, now, how many Caucasian guys are in the Burkina Faso national football team? So this is one of the smaller countries in Africa, and there's a picture of them. I retweeted it if you want to see it. And these guys look like they are ready for action, and they're all black. So then somebody says, Burkina Faso didn't colonize a white continent. So that's their comeback. First of all, the point that he made was excellent. You know, why aren't they complaining about the Burkina Faso national football team is not having any Caucasians on it? Because it doesn't matter. That's why. It's irrelevant. That's why. Because the vast majority of people who live in Burkina Faso, that nation in Africa, are black. The vast, vast majority of them. And this is true, generally speaking, of Italy. Maybe a little bit less so, but it's still true. So The Economist is worried and anxious and wringing its hands because there are no black faces on the Italian soccer team, championship team. They don't care about how the Burkina Faso national football team doesn't have any white faces because it's irrelevant. And then Alvaro Lopez, his cheeky comment, it's because Burkina Faso didn't colonize a white continent. And then Phoenix, who was it? It was, it's a little bit further down. I'm going to have to scroll for it. But there was a response to that guy which said, yeah, but Italy was not, it was not a country as we know it today until 1869 or whatever it was. That's why that doesn't matter, because Italy didn't exist as Italy until that time. And they were never, therefore, a colonizing power in the sense that they are a country right now. Different kingdoms may have been colonizing in Africa and elsewhere, but they weren't, say, Ethiopia, for example. But it wasn't Italy as a country as we know it today. It would be similar to saying, well, you know, the United States of America did X back in 1650, and somebody would have to point out, well, in 1650, there was no United States of America. It was England and its colonies. It's that kind of a thing. But this is lost on many people. And this gets to the issue that I've been speaking about fairly frequently on the program, and that is that this is a very dangerous thing where everything is being seen now, or you're supposed to see everything through the lens of race. This is what we're not supposed to do. We're supposed to see everybody as equal and be colorblind. That's what Martin Luther King had to say, and I certainly believe in that view. But the people who are promoting this new form of racism that masquerades under the guise of being anti-racist, that's really what they're after. They want to keep things, they want to keep the cauldron bubbling. They want to keep the temperature high and keep people unhappy. And that way they can exert power, because then they can control them. If people really were harmonious in terms of race, that group of people would not have the power that they have now. They would not be able to direct people's passions to accomplish things that can be accomplished by protests and riots and other things like that. There wouldn't be any of those things if people were happy with one another. So they have a vested interest in keeping people unhappy with each other. I think it's a very simple equation. One thing you can do about it, by the way, and that is pray the rosary. And you'll like how we have something for you that will help you pray the rosary. It's called Treasures of the Rosary, Reflections by Those Who Pray It Daily. It's a brand new Relevant Radio book. It's free. And by free, I mean the book is free, the shipping is free, the handling is free. There's really nothing at all that you pay for. Simply go to relevantradio.com/treasures with an S at the end, relevantradio.com/treasures, and you can sign up. It's not printed yet, but it will be soon. And when it is, we'll send it to you. So just give us your name and where you want it sent, and you'll receive it when it comes out. There is a limited supply, though. And that means that we want to make sure as many people as possible can get these. So when you sign up at relevantradio.com/treasures, there is a button there that you can forward the information to your friends and family so that they can sign up and get their free book as well. So again, go to relevantradio.com/treasures. You'll be very pleased with this book. It contains meditations on the rosary from St. John Paul II, from Father Rocky, our executive director, from St. Jose Maria, and it's replete with beautiful imagery throughout the entire book. So it's not just something to read, but also something to ponder as you consider these beautiful images of Our Lady. And we also want to welcome you and encourage you to join us for what we think of as the happiest half hour of your day, which is the Family Rosary Across America. That's at 7 p.m. Central, right here on Relevant Radio. Cyrus, you've heard and seen pictures of like the early Christian martyrs and being led into the arenas where the wild animals await them to devour them. You've heard of that. You've seen that before,
oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And Christians being fed to the lions,
right,
kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I have some interesting stuff here. Now, this is from it's a secular source, but I am thoroughly versed in the history that this article takes on. And so I can vouch for the fact that it is accurate. It's under the headline, Myth-Busting Ancient Rome, Throwing Christians to the Lions. And the author points out that there is a famous book. It's a wonderful book. I would highly recommend everyone to read. It's called Quo Vadis. It was written in 1895 by Henryk Sienkiewicz. He was a Polish author. It's just a wonderful book. And it takes place during the time of the apostles in Rome. And it is the genesis, at least in the modern mind, I think, of the idea of Christians being, quote-unquote, fed to the lions, martyred that way. And the book itself it's wonderful, it's exciting, it's thrilling, it is deeply moving, and it's set against the backdrop of the Emperor Nero in the mid-first century of Rome. So this is during the time of the apostles. St. Peter was in Rome, St. Paul was there for a time, and the church was in her infancy. And as you know, the story goes that when Nero, through his negligence and also wanting to build some bigger stuff, some bigger buildings, he had sections of Rome burned down, and it went out of control, and over half the city burned, and many people died, and he blamed it on the Christians. So this is well documented in church history. So he unleashed the first major persecution by the Roman Empire against Christianity. And we're going to get into some of those details here. So that's where this idea in the popular consciousness came out in terms of Christians being fed to the lions as the form of martyrdom. And then there was a 1951 version of this book that was made into a movie starring Peter Ustinov. And it was also a very good depiction of what was described in this book, Quo Vadis. Quo Vadis, by the way, means where are you going? And the backstory of that phrase, if you hear this, you know, Quo Vadis, what it means is, there is a place in Rome, it's just outside the old walls of Rome, and it's as you're on the road going toward the catacombs of St. Callistus in the outskirts of Rome. It's actually well inside Rome now, but in the ancient days, it was outside of the walled city of Rome. And the tradition is that St. Peter was fleeing from Rome because the persecution was starting under the Emperor Nero. And so he was going to get out of Dodge. And as he was leaving, walking away from the city, he encounters Jesus Christ walking toward the city. And he, of course, recognizes the Lord, and he says, Domine quo vadis, speaking in Latin here, Lord, where are you going? And the tradition is that Jesus said, well, you're leaving, so I'm going to go there to take care of the flock. Since you're leaving, I'm going to go there and take care of the flock. So this mystical experience has been enshrined there. In fact, there is a there's a church right on the spot where this purportedly took place. I have no reason to think it didn't take place, but there's a little church there that you can go in, and there's actually a stone, a large stone, that's on the floor up by the sanctuary of the church, and it has two footprints deeply embedded into the stone. And this, the tradition is that those are the footprints of Jesus Christ, because it was there that he was standing when St. Peter said to him, Domine quo vadis, where are you going? And when Jesus told him this, then Jesus vanished, and St. Peter turned around and went back to Rome and rallied the flock until he himself was put to death by being crucified upside down in Nero's circus. So that's where the title of the book comes from. So this article gets into the question of, you know, is this a myth? Is this really true that the Roman emperors, beginning with Nero, did they actually persecute the Christians? Did they really feed them to the lions? Is this kind of a wives' tale? What actually happened? So when we return from this break, we're going to take a break right now, and when we return, I'm going to share with you the whys and wherefores and what actually happened and what the specifics are and why we, even today, we think about lions eating Christians as a form of persecution. And I'll give you a heads up. I'll give you a sneak preview. It's all true. It's all really happened. And I'll give you some of the details as outlined in this article. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. I'm just waiting for the lady to talk. Is she going to talk, Cyrus? She's done talking. Okay. Welcome back. Okay, we're going to get to your phone calls in a minute. We were having some phone troubles a minute ago, so that's why we didn't have your phone calls sooner. I think we've got that taken care of. So those of you who are holding, thank you for your patience. I'll come to you here in just a little bit. First, I want to go through some of the details about what actually happened by way of persecutions against the early Christians. So here goes. Lactantius, a Christian professor of Latin and the church history of Eusebius, who is the bishop of Caesarea in modern-day Israel, those are two early church sources that give us a lot of details about what happened in these persecutions. These authors were living in the reign of Constantine, the first Christian emperor, and tasked themselves with charting the history of Christian suffering up to that moment. In both their works, the torture and execution of Christians in preceding centuries is associated with the emperors under whom they occurred. But the reality is that the punishment of Christians in the first three centuries was largely haphazard and not directed by imperial policy. That is actually not entirely true. It was, in certain instances, ordered by the emperors themselves. But in specific cases, they were done, these things were ordered as a way to combat what the emperors thought was a threat to the empire itself. The Emperor Nero is the first persecutor of the Christians. He's mentioned by Lactantius. After the Great Fire of Rome in the year 64, when rumors swirled that the emperor himself was responsible, he blamed the Christians instead. According to the Roman historian Tacitus, Nero had the Christians covered in wild beast skins and torn to death by dogs. That's not all he did, by the way. He had some garden parties in his palatial estates, and because they were at night, he of course needed tiki torches, and the fuel for the tiki torches turned out to be Christian men, women, and children who were tied to these stakes covered in pitch and then lit on fire. And so I don't know how you can possibly imagine eating your hors d'oeuvres while somebody is dying so agonizingly right near you, but apparently they were able to live with that. So he did have Christians killed in a variety of ways, but this did include being torn to death by hungry dogs. Tacitus describes Christianity as a pernicious superstition. The Christians themselves, he called them degraded and sordid. However, No ancient Roman writers suggest that these Christians were persecuted for their faith alone. They were charged with committing the crime of arson. The unpopularity of the Christians with other Romans is made clear by letters exchanged by Pliny the Younger, governor of Bithynia, which is in modern-day North Turkey, and the Emperor Trajan in the early 2nd century. Pliny reported that the provincials had been denouncing others to him and even anonymously posting the names of suspected Christians. Trajan, the emperor, replied as follows. He says, "They must not be searched for, but if they are denounced and found guilty, they must be punished." So, first of all, these letters between Pliny the Younger and the Emperor Trajan are widely available. Thankfully, they've come down to us intact. So you can read them for yourself. Just go to the Googles and type in Pliny the Younger, P-L-I-N-Y, or the Emperor Trajan, and you'll find these letters and you can read them. And you can see exactly what they said. Trajan's letter effectively expressed the Roman state policy regarding Christians as a sort of don't ask, don't tell policy, which lasted until the year 250. However, this did not put an end to denunciations by provincials who felt uneasy or threatened by Christians in their community. So we see an example of this in the case of Polycarp of Smyrna. St. Polycarp and the martyrs of Lyon and Vienne, who were harassed by members of the local population, were subsequently brought to trial. This is how emperors such as Marcus Aurelius earned the label of a persecutor. The initiative to punish Christians did not come from the emperors at all, but it came from below. In the case of St. Polycarp, who was burned alive, the people of Smyrna were said to even have joined enthusiastically to find the wood for the fire. The punishments meted out to Christians who admitted their religion and refused to sacrifice to the pagan gods varied. In the first and early second centuries, Christians who were Roman citizens, including the Apostle Paul, were executed by beheading, which was considered quick and merciful. Later in the second century, beheading was a privilege to which only the highest-ranking citizens were automatically entitled. The lesser sort, as they were known, were subject to more violent punishments. These included being crucified, burned to death, and attacked by wild beasts. Being condemned to the beasts was a particularly grisly end, this article points out. It meant that you and your companions would be exposed in the arena to a variety of wild, ferocious animals, such as leopards, bears, lions, and you'd be required to fight for your lives. Of course, they knew that you were not going to win this fight. These animals had been starved for a few days, and they were hungry, and you were the prey. This would happen as part of a day-long festival of violence and slaughter. It was usually scheduled during the lunchtime to provide some light relief. During the birthday celebrations for the emperor's son at Carthage, it was evidently thought amusing to match the female martyrs, Perpetua and Felicity, with an angry heifer who tossed them into the air and crushed them. And the acts of Saints Felicity and Perpetua are available to us as well. So the description of what they went through in their martyrdom is just astonishing. So then it goes into some of the other persecutions, and it talks about how most of the time they were localized. Sometimes they were empire-wide, like the persecution of the Emperor Decius that ordered all Romans everywhere to sacrifice to the gods, and then they had to have a certificate to prove that they had done so. And if you didn't do this, then you would be put in prison and you would be executed because you were considered subversive. If you didn't throw a pinch of incense into the brazier before the idol of the Roman god, typically it would be Caesar, you would be considered subversive and they would kill you and your kids. So this went on, and the article gets into some additional detail about it, but it goes on until the time of the Emperor Constantine, who, in the early part of the 4th century, lifted all of these sanctions against Christians and welcomed Christianity, a.k.a. the Catholic Church, into full recognition by the state. He even gave the Pope at the time, Pope Sylvester, he gave him the Lateran Palace as a place for the church to have its center of administration and a church where mass could be celebrated, etc. And it shortly after that became the official religion of the empire. So how things change in such a short period of time, it's amazing. So if you're interested, read the book, Quo Vadis, and you can also read the more contemporary account of it in this article that Cyrus will get posted for you on the show Twitter feed, which is available by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's get to the phones now. And again, thank you everybody who have been waiting so patiently. Let's go to Bernice in Washington. Good morning, Bernice.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Wonderful. just the thought process, and you were speaking about dysphoria, and many of the big businesses are buying into this non-gender, non-binary.
Right.
And my thought process is perhaps some of the dysphoria of our youth is due to a lack of God in their daily life, lack of daily prayer, or truly knowing God on a daily basis. You know, parents, if you notice, a lot of this has happened since mothers have gone back to working, and they're not providing that daily prayer at meals. They're not providing that daily rosary or the chaplet. And I have found, at least in my own life, that the more I pray, the more I know I'm a child of God and what is right and what is good. And so my thought process, and again, it just kind of hit me this morning. I thought perhaps the reason why people don't know who they are and what they are is that they don't know God. And we've taken God out of our schools. We've taken God out of our daily life. Stores are now open on Sunday, whereas when I was a kid, the only store that was open was 7-Eleven. You know, I just a theory. Want to know your thought?
I understand what you're saying, and I do see where you could see a kind of a correlation between the two. Let me propose a hypothesis to you, Bernice, that may sharpen this pencil a little bit, because I remember, I guess in the 60s, it was probably just at the tail end of when it was permissible to have a picture of the Ten Commandments in a public school, or it was permissible to have a prayer. I don't remember anything like that by the time we get to 1970. So by the time I was like in middle school or something, I don't remember that anymore. But I do have memories of it, kind of the last vestiges in the 60s. But you'll notice this, Bernice. You didn't have a transgender movement. You didn't have the LGBTQ++ movement in any overt way in the mainstream in our society in the 60s and 70s. And not even really as much anyway, at least into the 80s. But in the 90s, it really began to take hold. And I've thought a lot about this and have wondered what led to that, because these things don't happen in a vacuum, obviously. And here's my hypothesis. My hypothesis is that, at least in some measure, this has been engendered by the rise of and the mass proliferation of pornography. And here's why I say this. Pornography was not easy to get in the 1940s or 50s. I was born in 1960, so I can only speak from personal experience beyond that point. It was not easy to get. And it wasn't portable unless you were to go to a bookstore, or go to some seedy part of town, and you know, people who are on looking for that stuff would know where to find it. But by and large, the average person never came into any contact with it. You didn't see it in the movies. You didn't see it in television programs. It certainly wasn't permitted by the censors in popular society. So the average person didn't really have an occasion to see pornography. But then, thank you, Hugh Hefner. He got his start in the 60s, and eventually, by the time you get into the 70s, the magazine industry, of course, was very widespread, Playboy and the others. So that's where it, I think, really began to seep into the popular consciousness, and pornography became more widely available. Well, just think about what has happened since then with the arrival of the internet and now the rise of smartphones and the instantaneous access to this world of pornography that is everywhere. You can hardly get away from it. Now, the reason I am emphasizing this is because notice what to me appears to be a sort of concomitant rise in these movements that are tracking more or less the same way as the rise in availability of pornography. And the essence of my theory is simply this, that when people become subjected to these images and these ideas that they never would have thought of before, it never would have entered their minds, most of them anyway, to consider these perversions or even be aware of them. They wouldn't even know that such things existed in many cases. When society begins to marinate in a constant flow of pornographic images and pornographic ideas and suggesting to people things that they never otherwise might have thought about before, it will take a toll on them. and it will begin to warp and distort the way that they look at other people, and it will begin to warp and distort the way they look at themselves. And so I do believe that in addition to what you're pointing out, that there's something to be said for why we didn't have these bizarre sexual problems going on in society in the 50s and 60s and even really into the 70s. But why do we start seeing them from the 80s and later? Because the floodgates opened, the pornography tsunami went everywhere and touched practically everybody. And the inevitable effects of this was it began to warp and change the way people looked at each other and themselves. And it also, it unleashed or it awoke the concupiscence in many people and the desire to experiment and to seek new thrills and to, maybe I'll try that. I really think that there's a correlation between that and what we're seeing today. So there's my theory in a nutshell, Bernice. What are your thoughts?
Well, and I agree with you. I was reading, and just happenstance found it on the internet last weekend when my fiance and I were Googling different 70s shows like Petticoat Junction and Green Acres and that kind of thing. And one of the things under Green Acres said that they were canceled at the height, that they were really very popular, and they were canceled in place, and what took their place was shows like Maude, Soap, All in the Family. And so you see this in like 1972 going forward. Maude was one of the first sitcoms that introduced abortion.
Right. Maude had an abortion.
And yes.
Maude herself had an abortion. And it was so shocking. I remember being shocked, and I remember my parents being shocked. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe
I remember my parents saying we couldn't watch that program any longer.
Yeah.
I remember that. I mean, and I was a kid. I was 10, 12 years old. So, yeah, I'm just saying that Hollywood had that influence as well as, like you say, pornography, because that introduced it. Soap, with that character that was played by Billy Crystal, the first gay person. That was, I think, 1978, 1980, somewhere right in there. And so that started bringing in the realization that, oh, this is acceptable. And what we tolerate now will be accepted by the next generation. So we tolerated some of those things without saying anything. And, oh, it's just one show. It's not a big deal. We now have come to accept it as being normal when it isn't normal. Yeah. It's not in the Christian lifestyle. I mean, I know that it's normal for others who have no God to give them the direction of right and wrong.
Right. But even, I'm not disagreeing with you. But even if you remove God from the equation, which I am, as you know, not want to do, even if you remove God from the equation, something else happened that goes beyond just having no prayer in school or not allowing pictures of the Ten Commandments in school. Something much more disruptive took place, and you are correct in pointing out that it was shows like that that began to mainstream certain attitudes to the American public. I'll leave it at this. Bernice, and thank you for the phone call. I remember very vividly enjoying All in the Family, you know, Archie and Edith and Meathead and the whole cast of characters. And Norman Lear, the guy who produced that, the guy who came up with this idea, he was very smart, because Norman Lear was not what you would call conservative. And he recognized that there was a very effective way to not just merely subvert conservative ideas and conservative people, but to make a mockery of them by making the personification of conservatism this twisted caricature in the form of Archie Bunker. So Archie Bunker was the quintessential angry middle-aged white man who was a white supremacist. He was very racist. He was very intolerant. He was very angry. He was mean to his wife. I mean, anything you can think of that would be socially unacceptable was personified by Archie Bunker. But the thing is, Archie Bunker was funny. And when people are given medicine, if you give them some medicine that's in something sweet, they'll taste the sweet and they won't notice the medicine. And in this case, the reverse happened, where people were being not radicalized, but people were being, what's the word I want? Their views, their attitudes on things were being reshaped without them even realizing it with programs like All in the Family, because they learned to laugh at traditional things, because the person who was ostensibly promoting so-called traditional whatever, he himself was a buffoon. He was easy to laugh at. He was easy to hate. He was easy to look down on. And so what happened is, over time, the more and more of these things that came out, the more it became customary for people to not really think through what was going on. And they would come to scorn the ideas that they thought were associated with clowns like Archie Bunker. Fascinating, as Dr. Spot would say. Spock. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show and your phone calls right after this quick timeout.
Get that in your spirit.